This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony. For the rest of his life, Ralph Vaughan Williams remembered the exact moment the idea for his London Symphony took hold in his mind. It happened in 1911 at the suggestion of his friend George Butterworth, a fellow folk song collector and a gifted composer who would lose his life in World War I. Vaughan Williams was 40 years old and well-established in the music world, but he had yet to write the kind of large-scale, purely instrumental work that had been the benchmark for serious composers for over a century, a symphony. When he was 9 years old, Vaughan Williams had passed a University of Edinburgh correspondence course in music and had begun piano and theory lessons with his aunt, Sophie Wedgwood, of the Wedgwood China Wedgwoods. He had gone to Charterhouse, the Royal College of Music, and Trinity College, Cambridge, and studied with Max Bruch. And just before his meeting with Butterworth, he had taken some time off from composing, teaching, editing, and conducting to sharpen his technique with lessons from Maurice Ravel. Vaughan Williams had begun collecting folk songs in 1903, and soon afterwards he joined the English Folk Song Society. It was a critical step toward finding his own musical voice, and also one that cemented his lifelong friendship and artistic alliance with the composer Gustav Holst. The music of earlier English masters, such as Thomas Tallis, William Byrd, and Henry Purcell, had become an important part of his life. He had contributed articles to Grove's Dictionary of Music and Musicians, had put considerable energy into elevating the standards of amateur choral singing in England, and had undertaken the enormous task of assembling, updating, and editing the English hymnal. Some of its best tunes, still popular today, were actually written by Vaughan Williams himself. His Norfolk Rhapsodies and song cycle On Wenlock Edge had established Vaughan Williams' standing as a composer, and his finest accomplishment to this point was actually a byproduct of his work on the hymnal, the Fantasia on a Theme of Thomas Tallis. This was the first work in which he spoke completely and confidently the language of his English heritage. But what Vaughan Williams had not yet done was write a large-scale instrumental work. Despite its title, a sea symphony, which he had written the previous year, was more a cantata than an actual symphony. And this was what had provoked George Butterworth's peremptory challenge to his older friend. So, with what his widow Ursula Vaughan Williams calls infinite struggle, the composer's first instrumental symphony slowly came into being. For a performance in 1920, after several revisions, Vaughan Williams wrote a characteristically reticent program note. Quote, "The title A London Symphony may suggest to some hearers a descriptive piece, but this is not the intention of the composer. A better title would perhaps be Symphony by a Londoner, that is to say, the life of London, including possibly its various sights and sounds, has suggested to the composer an attempt at musical expression. But it would be no help to the hearer to describe these in words. The music is intended to be self-expressive and must stand or fall as absolute music. Therefore, if listeners recognize such things as the Westminster chimes or the lavender cry, they are asked to consider these as accidents, not essentials of the music." End quote. In a note for a performance in Liverpool 5 years later, Vaughan Williams had been slightly more willing to admit to the pictorial element, mentioning such details as the suggestion of mouth organs and mechanical pianos in the scherzo, giving the symphony a tinge of local color, end quote. But again, he insisted that the work is intended to be listened to as absolute music. As time went by, though, Vaughan Williams became, bit by bit, more willing to acknowledge the importance of the programmatic side of a London symphony. A visitor to today's London would be hard-pressed to find it in the portrait Vaughan Williams painted in this work. Think more of the London of My Fair Lady or Mary Poppins. The sound that emerges from silence at the beginning is that of cellos and basses, muted and pianissimo. Now, Claude Monet produced some of his most evocative paintings in London, one of his favorite subjects being the Thames, shrouded in mists. In his Vaughan Williams book for the Master Musicians series, James Day writes that a London symphony is, in effect, a vivid translation into musical terms of a Monet exhibition with London as its theme. End quote. All that mighty heart of the city is lying still, said Vaughan Williams of this opening music, quoting Wordsworth. Slowly the sun rises, and through the gradually dispersing mist, we hear the Westminster chimes, Big Ben, softly striking the half hour. A crescendo with trilling woodwinds spills into the allegro. Vaughan Williams wrote that this music may perhaps suggest the noise and hurry of London with its always underlying calm. Tune after tune appears, many of which clearly inspired later composers such as Leonard Bernstein, John Williams, and Andrew Lloyd Webber. And when the opening theme returns, it brings the movement to a grand conclusion. Vaughan Williams noted that the second movement has been called Bloomsbury Square on a November afternoon, but backpedaled hastily to add that this may serve as a clue to the music, but it is not necessarily an explanation of it. When he wrote about this symphony in the Royal College of Music magazine, George Butterworth said, "The slow movement is an idyll of gray skies and secluded byways, an aspect of London quite as familiar as any other. The feeling of the music is remote and mystical, and its very characteristic beauty is not of a kind which it is possible to describe in words." End quote. Like the Largo of Dvorak's New World Symphony, this movement is full of themes that sound like folk songs, but are completely original. And the rich orchestral textures also recall Dvorak's Ninth. The melody introduced by the solo viola is actually the cry of a lavender seller that Vaughan Williams had noted down on a Chelsea street in 1911. Von Williams wrote that the third movement is a nocturne in the form of a scherzo. If the hearer will imagine himself standing on Westminster Embankment at night, surrounded by the distant sounds of the Strand, with its great hotels on one side and the New Cut on the other, with its crowded streets and flaring lights, it may serve as a mood in which to listen to this movement. The central section evokes the raucous sounds of harmonica, which the English call mouth organ, and player piano. The scherzo returns in an abbreviated form, and the movement ends with the sounds of the night fading away. The last word goes to a chattering bassoon, appearing like the last customer emerging from a pub and reeling away into the night. The finale was the movement that cost Von Williams the most trouble and which went through the most changes. It begins with a great cry for the full orchestra, leading to a solemn march. Something dark is the subject here, though Von Williams never let on what it might be. The music of the first movement reappears, and gradually the atmosphere becomes calmer. When all has subsided to pianissimo, we again hear the distant sound of Big Ben, now chiming the three-quarter hour. And finally, the music, once again in muted strings, slowly sinks back into those dark depths where it had begun. Toward the end of his life, Von Williams gave his biographer Michael Kennedy a clue about these last minutes of his symphony. For actual coda, see end of Wells' Tono Bungay. H.G. Wells' partly autobiographical novel, written 4 years before a London symphony, ends with the narrator sailing on a destroyer down the Thames estuary and toward the open sea. Quote, "To run down the Thames so is to run one's hand over the pages in the Book of England from end to end. Out to the open we go, to windy freedom and trackless ways. Light after light goes down, England and the kingdom, the old prides and the old devotion, glide abeam, astern, sink down upon horizons, pass, pass. The river passes, London passes, England passes." End quote. Written on the eve of World War I, Von Williams' A London Symphony was the soundtrack to the end of an empire. This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony.